The landscape around us is not flat like, say, Nebraska. It's bumpy and interesting because the Earth moves. That's not past tense, obviously. The Earth still moves in our region, blessed as it is with the edges of tectonic plates and volcanoes. The Cascadia subduction zone, where two major plates meet, has been the focus of scientific attention for decades now. The next Cascadia quake could be a big one. Chris Goldfinger has been studying the zone for a long time. He's a professor at Oregon State University, a marine geologist and geophysicist, and paleoseismologist. He gives the next geology lecture at Southwestern Oregon Community College tonight at 7 p.m. online. Chris Goldfinger, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, Jeffrey. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. I noticed the lecture is on this, the 322nd anniversary of the last Cascadia quake. How do we know that?
Well, it's a bit of a long story, but the way we know it in detail is the arrival of a tsunami in Japan. And Japan had written records of its arrival and arrival time. And so you can back calculate the tsunami travel time and come up with 9 p.m. January 26, 1700 in Pacific Standard Time.
Wow. So let's talk about the research then generally into Cascadia subduction zone quakes and how far apart we assume they are.
Well, so the research has evolved over a number of years. People working on tsunami deposits and land subsidence deposits onshore, and submarine landslide deposits called turbidites offshore. And so, together, if you fit a model that agrees with all the data sets the best, we wind up with about 46 earthquakes over 10,000 years, which is a really good long record for any fault system. And so the big ones in the magnitude 9 range, that like the 1700 event, seem to happen on average about every 430 years. But there are about 20 of those in 10,000 years. And there are about 26 more that are smaller, and by smaller I mean magnitude 7 to 8 earthquakes. These are still big earthquakes, but quite a bit smaller than the 9s. And those together with the big ones, they are segmented, meaning they stop at different latitude bands. And so they at the latitude of Portland, it's about 320 years. Latitude of say, Coos Bay, it's down to about 280 years. And then further south, it drops down to about 250 years.
So there's really no way of knowing it, or is there, of which what the next one would be? I mean, what the approximate range might be and what kind?
Yeah, no, unfortunately. So it's been 322 years since the last really big one. 1992 was actually the last small one. We had a magnitude 7.1 in Petrolia, southernmost Cascadia, right down near Humboldt County. And so, but what's, you know, we've learned a lot about the fault. We've learned a lot about the earthquake history.
Well, that sounds like a phone going away. We will pick it up on the other side. Chris Goldfinger, of course, famous not just for his ongoing work, but because he was part of the story in The New Yorker several years ago about the next big one, a Cascadia fault line quake that would really shake a good bit of this region. And it was centered around Portland. And that piece, of course, won the Pulitzer Prize for Catherine Schultz, the New Yorker reporter who put it together. And it was interesting, too, because of the fact that, you know, here we've been talking about Cascadia for quite some time within Cascadia itself. We live here. And yet it took a piece in the New Yorker to really blow the lid off of people getting really super interested in what's going on there. So we're trying to get Chris Goldfinger's phone line reestablished there. And it looks like we have him back. So here we can go. Back to Chris Goldfinger, we think. Got him? Okay. So, Chris, what we were talking about was periods in particular that it's really hard to say what the next one might be. 1992 in Petrolia was the last one of any size?
Right, yeah. And so we've learned a lot about these faults and their histories, but it's not very predictive. In other words, we'd love to know when the next one is, but so far, there's really no clue, so we can really only look back in the past and get forecast probabilities into the future, not a prediction.
I was just talking about the New Yorker piece in which you were quoted extensively, the one that won the Pulitzer Prize. It's just some irony, isn't there, that it took a New Yorker piece to let people know, to kind of spread the word and really crystallize thinking about the next Cascadia quake?
Yeah, it's especially to a West Coaster like me. I did not really understand the impact of the New Yorker. I thought it was a publication that mostly piled up in dentist's offices and you know, didn't really, and had Manhattan-centric cartoons that nobody else could understand. But when that article came out, then I found out how influential the New Yorker really is, and I dug into it a little bit, and I found out that I was sort of the odd man out. And everybody I knew reads the New Yorker, and their influence goes back, you know, back before World War II in big, important ways. So I was very surprised. Cascadia had been featured in NOVA episodes and National Geographic and a lot of things. And I think most of us who work in this field thought that everybody knew this story already, but that was not the case. And the New Yorker really brought it out in a huge way.
So what would you say, though, still is the greatest deficiency in understanding the potential for a big quake in the region?
The greatest deficiency?
Yeah.
Well, I guess I would say that there really isn't one. I mean, Cascadia has gone from a complete unknown in 1985 to one of the best-known faults in the world at this point. So we have a longer record and more detailed record than any subduction zone and perhaps any fault in the world at this point. So, but the question now isn't so much on the science side. There isn't. I don't think that there are any big surprises out there lurking, or big things that we're going to see in the future. I might be wrong about that. But the big thing now is that society is completely unprepared for all of this, and we've built our cities, you know, long before plate tectonics even existed, let alone understanding of Cascadia. So we have a very fragile built environment sitting on top of what amounts to a time bomb, and it's a tough thing for society to grapple with and to try to get ourselves, all of us, moving towards the kind of resiliency, say, that Japan has, which is kind of where we need to be, really.
You were quoted during the Great American Shakeout, speaking of our built environment, about not wanting to do drop, cover, and hold on, at least in the building where you work. Why do you find some issue with that particular approach?
Well, so drop, cover, and hold on was really imported from California and also from Japan. And California is about 90 years ahead of us in terms of building codes and earthquake codes. And Japan is really 1,000 years ahead of us. They've had shoguns' castles knocked down for 1,000 years, and they finally learned how to become resilient. So in the Pacific Northwest, though, we have a lot of collapse hazard buildings. And so importing a mantra like that that works well in an environment where the buildings won't collapse is problematic at the very best for the Pacific Northwest. So I mentioned the building that I work in is a collapse hazard. I'm on the ground floor near the door, and so if I get a warning, either a light shaking from an earthquake or from a warning system, I'm probably not going to wait for 2 or 3 minutes under my desk for the building to collapse. So that's my personal situation, and so what I'm kind of advocating for is a broader discussion about other protective actions that are very specific to specific towns, specific structure types, and specific buildings that might perform better and save more lives than drop, cover, and hold on. And so it's a little bit controversial. The emergency management folks want a very simple, single message, but I'm not sure that that's going to work the best for folks.
Chris Goldfinger, our guest on the Deverson Exchange from Oregon State University, a geophysicist, a seismogeologist, you name it. He's got a lot of information in his pocket about the Cascadia subduction zone. He delivers the geology lecture series, a Cascadia anniversary lecture for Southwestern Oregon Community College online tonight at 7. You can join the conversation right here, right now on the exchange at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Ken in Grand Lawrence Pass sent in a couple of questions here about landslides, particularly in the Klamath Mountains and coast ranges of Oregon and California. So his first question, has there been any research that associates such landslides with great earthquakes in the Cascadia Zone? And is there other evidence that suggests how the landscape might respond to great earthquakes like soil liquefaction or, in fact, landslides?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You would expect with magnitude 9 earthquakes that there would be lots and lots of landslides all over the place. And in Japan, they had tons of landslides. I was there for that earthquake and got to see that. The problem that we had is that we have lots and lots of landslides every time it rains, and it rains a lot in the Pacific Northwest. So the trick is to try to find the earthquake-triggered landslides and somehow distinguish them from the everyday rain, you know, induced landslides. And so it's a bit of a needle in a haystack situation. And so far, there's not a single landslide that's been definitively associated with the 1700 or any of the other Cascadia earthquakes. And some people from U of O and USGS have been looking for this, but not found so far. It's a difficult thing to do, and it's also difficult to date landslides to get the precision to compare to the earthquake record.
They don't provide things like the core samples you get from the ocean floor?
I'm sorry, could you say again?
They don't. I mean, landslides don't give a good geological record like those core samples you get from the ocean floor?
Well, they do, but in the ocean environment, it's very simple. At the right type of site, you really only get the submarine landslide deposits and nothing else. So they're relatively easy to distinguish. Whereas on land, you get these rain-induced landslides all the time. And so you have a few earthquake landslides sprinkled into this huge field of other landslides, and you have to try to figure out, you know, which is which.
Another question from Randy and Roosh by email wants to know about the potential for coastal land subsidence and how fast this might occur in a large Cascadia quake. I mean, the landscape in Oregon is bumped up from having the Pacific Plate go under, right?
Well, it's bulging upward when it's under stress, sort of like we're compressing a spring right now with the two plates locked up, and so the coastline is slowly going upward now. During the earthquake, most of it, except for Cape Blanco and except for parts of Humboldt County, most of it will go down, and the amount is somewhere between half a meter to as much as a meter and a half, and this will all take place within about 3 minutes. So it's very fast. Sudden subsidence, so all of the bays will suddenly get larger, and so on. And so parts of the shorelines and the estuaries will become part of the bay, and that'll be essentially permanent for probably a couple of hundred years.
Oh, wow. I hadn't thought about that part of it. When the land is lower, the water, therefore, is higher, which is obviously a concern at the Humboldt Bay area, as we've talked about with them in the past, but lots of other areas, too.
Yeah, so there'll be some ups and some downs. Humboldt, it's not clear what Humboldt is going to do. It could go either up or down, depending on the exact sort of configuration of the earthquake. But most of the Pacific Northwest coast will go down, and it's been recorded as going down in the last 7 or 8 events, so we're pretty confident about that.
So, Chris Goldfinger, as the rest of us have learned about this, it's interesting. You say it was unknown in 1985, which is actually when I moved to Oregon. So this has all sort of come in that time. And it seems like there are constant revelations for those of us who are not directly connected to the science. Do you remember any particular moments for you in the whole process of realizing what it was that Cascadia had in potential?
Well, yeah, I think the big one for me was, the early work that was done by Brian Atwater along the coast was very revealing and convincing. The trick was, though, could you say that those big events that he was seeing in Southwest Washington really extended the full length of Cascadia, which goes from the middle of Vancouver Island down to Humboldt County? And the really convincing moment, though, was when Kenji Satake found the evidence in Japan for this so-called orphan tsunami that had arrived one day in 1700 without an earthquake. And that was so convincing, and it really required a magnitude 9 earthquake. There was really no way around that. And very little interpretation was required to arrive at that conclusion. And that was the big turnaround for me, because before that, I was a little bit on the fence about all the evidence. You know, it looked convincing in some places, and less so in others, but the big wave arrival in Japan was what did it for me.
So given the advances in technology since 1985, I mean, just in consumer technology and the advances in science, great too. I'm thinking about the Webb Space Telescope, for example, at the moment. But here on Earth, I imagine that there have been great gains. Are there still some things missing, things you'd like to have that you don't have to be able to further refine the knowledge about the Cascadia subduction zone?
Oh, yeah, that list would be a really long list for sure. You know, geology has not, even though technology has changed a lot and we're using, you know, high-tech devices, we use, you know, medical-grade CT scanners to image the interiors of our core samples, for example, things like that. But we're still unable to really image the interior of the Earth very well at the kind of depths that we need to deal with earthquakes. And we're still unable to tell, for example, how strongly coupled the fault is. You know, like if you cook a turkey, you can put in a meat thermometer and you can tell when it's done. But with the Earth, there's no equivalent to that. We can't tell when a fault is about ready to let go. We'd really love to be able to do that. And there's just no known technology and nothing really even on the horizon for that. But maybe someday there will be.
No device that would measure what you need to measure and no place to put it?
Yeah. But no place to put it is the hardest part.
Right.
We need to put this device, whatever it is, you know, 40 or 50 kilometers down, about, you know, 10 times farther than drilling technology can deal with.
And you were in you mentioned being in Japan during the Tohoku quake, right?
Right, yes.
And so was that the first or was that the largest quake you've been in personally?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and we've had magnitude 5 or 6 earthquakes pretty frequently, and they were a regular occurrence. But the one in Japan was obviously it started out small, and we thought, oh, another small earthquake. We were there for an earthquake meeting, and there were 2 or 3 earthquakes that week, and we thought, oh, here's another one. It's just going to interrupt, my colleagues' talk at this meeting, and then it just sort of kept going. It wasn't. There was a full minute of very light shaking, which equates to the P wave arrivals from the earthquake, and then it started shaking in more. You know, so we knew that once it had gone past a minute, it was a pretty good earthquake, pretty big earthquake. And once it went past 2 minutes, we knew it was probably greater than 8. And when it hit 3 minutes, that's pretty much the clue for all of us that it was a 9. And we were fortunate in many ways that we were in Japan. We were in a bulletproof, brand new, earthquake-resistant building. So we knew there was no hazard to us particularly. So all the 40 of us at this meeting could watch this unfold and learn from it. And that's what we did. It was very instructive to bring an earthquake like that out of the sort of theoretical realm that we all work in and into the real world where we could just see what it was really like.
All right, Chris Goldfinger from Oregon State University giving the geology lecture at Southwestern Oregon Community College online tonight at 7. Thanks so much.